your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off this hour with some really prophetic interviews that Alex Jones had. Was interviewed actually by Jesse Ventura years ago, and he was addressing this pandemic. Pandemic type of angle way back then. And then Dr. LeBeau was also interviewed by Jesse Ventura also. And we're going to follow with an interview with her also. So these are very, very insightful types of interviews. Here we go now. And this precedes by years what's going on today. You need to know this. Here we go now.
We're seeing a medical tyranny being set up, not just in the United States, but worldwide under the UN and the World Health Organization.
Who's behind all this?
The Bilderberg Group. They want a planetary dictatorship so they can carry out their force depopulation agenda, and they want to do it through the medical system. And that's why vaccines are so important. And I've got an insider I think you should really talk to, Dr. Rima Lebo. But she doesn't live inside the United States because she's so concerned about all the police state developments that are taking place.
As soon as you and I finish,
you're out.
I'm leaving the country again. Why? Because in a very short time, not today, not tomorrow, but very soon, we'll be facing compulsory vaccination under the mistaken term of voluntary vaccination. Well, first of all, let's start with the fact that the World Health Organization has decided that we have 90% too many people. The World Health Organization has been working since 1974 on vaccines to create permanent sterility. They will induce a pandemic using the nasal mist vaccine, which is a live attenuated virus. That means that if I take it, I can infect you. You're going to get the flu. Everybody around us is going to get the flu. Then the United States government, based on their statements that they've already made, will say, oh my, we have a pandemic. Oh my goodness, we don't have enough doses. So we'll admix squalene at the 90,000 injection stations that the Department of Health and Human Services announced that they will ship the vaccines to.
People lining up, sometimes by the hundreds, for an H1N1 flu shot.
This show aired one time, and it was deleted and taken off TiVo's. It aired one time, and it was taken off of even the DVRs had it erased. It was a big national scandal. The police state episode, both the ones that I got on the guest, I did the research, and I am proud of it. And I am taking credit, by the way. I mean, I basically, those are real reality shows. Most reality shows are fake. But you still script what you're going to talk about and where you're going to go and what you're going to do. So we'd go real places and real things would happen. But what we were going to talk about, we'd already discussed. And so I basically had to vet all the documents. I had to show them proof of where Kissinger said it. I had to prove to them what Lebeau was saying was true by statements from other globalists, or they weren't going to interview Lebeau. And so, again, that's why it was so vetted. They had congressional hearings calling for silencing that episode. Why would you have congressional hearings? Well, Obama saw it and flipped out because the show's got record ratings for Ventura's program. And then the shows re-aired hundreds of times, three seasons, over 30 shows. But those two didn't. Those two aired once and were removed because those are the two episodes that yours truly vetted and did the research for and wrote the research for.
This thing is real. It did come out of Wuhan lab. And Dr. Yan is interviewed again by Tucker Carlson just this last Friday. And here's what she had to say about the origin of that of the virus and so forth. And boy, the Chinese government is trying to give us a load of disinformation, misinformation, and lies. Here we go, Dr. Yan, interviewed by Tucker Carlson.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson's Night. Happy Friday. One of the first questions that rational people asked, and there still are some rational people out there, after the coronavirus arrived in the U.S. last year was simple. Where did this disease come from? Now, finding out was more than a matter of simple curiosity. It was an urgent public health imperative. If you want to prevent the next disaster, you have to determine how the current disaster happened. That's why they have the NTSB. If we didn't investigate plane crashes very carefully, planes would keep crashing and you would never fly. So as this virus spread around the world last year, the rest of us waited for some credible public health authority, the CDC, the WHO, anyone, to come forward with details on where it came from. But no one ever did come forward. Instead, they told us what was, in retrospect, a completely ridiculous story. They said a seafood market in central China was, for reasons that no one ever explained, selling mammals, exotic ones like pangolins, and those pangolins somehow became a vector for infection. So the Chinese eat weird food, that's why the world is sick. That's what they told us. In China, they knew that wasn't true. They knew it very early. On February 6th of 2020, right at the very beginning, scientists from the South China University of Technology uploaded a paper on the origins of coronavirus onto the internet. They had a very different view of what happened. The virus, these scientists said, likely came from an animal called the intermediate horseshoe bat. It's interesting, they said, because there are no known colonies of intermediate horseshoe bats within 900 kilometers of Wuhan, nor were these bats sold in the famous wet market there. In fact, the scientists interviewed nearly 60 people who worked or shopped in the wet market and all confirmed no horseshoe bats for sale. So they believe COVID jumped from bats to people. When and where and how did that happen? Well, the scientists noted the obvious. Within a few hundred yards of the Wuhan wet market was something called the Wuhan Center for Disease Control and Prevention. It turns out that facility used intermediate horseshoe bats for research. Then about 7 miles away was another facility. This one was called the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The Wuhan Institute of Virology also conducted research on intermediate horseshoe bats. So for these Chinese scientists who were working on the ground at the epicenter of the outbreak, at the very beginning of the outbreak, the conclusion was obvious. Quote, the killer coronavirus probably originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. Again, that was the first week of February in 2020. That research sat on the internet for weeks before the Chinese authorities finally pulled it down, and they have. We don't know what happened to the people who wrote it, but we have a copy. The amazing thing is, even though this was public, health officials in the West ignored it completely. When they were asked about the possibility that this virus had come from a lab in Wuhan, they became hostile. In some cases, they became hysterical. For example, in a post on the National Institutes of Health website, NIH Director Francis Collins, who should know better, dismissed all questions about a lab leak in Wuhan as, quote, outrageous, like you were sinful for asking the question. But those questions were not outrageous. They were entirely plausible. Last fall, we spoke to someone with firsthand knowledge of this subject. Dr. Li Mengyan is an eminent Chinese virologist who worked on COVID in China in the early days of the pandemic. She was certain, based on what she had seen, that this virus came from a lab in Wuhan. On September 15, 2020, Dr. Yan came on this show and said so.
From my first report, I can present the solid scientific evidence to our audience that this virus, COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 virus, actually is not from nature. I work with the top coronavirologists in the world. So, together with my experience, I can tell you, this is created in the lab. This is from that template owned by China military. And also it is spread to the world to make such damage.
to make such damage, do you believe the Chinese government released this intentionally, on purpose? Did they do this?
Yes, of course, it's intentionally.
That was a strong claim, but Li Mengyan had even stronger credentials. Once again, she was a Chinese virologist who personally did research on COVID in China at the very beginning of the outbreak. So she was not an internet fabulist. She had informed firsthand knowledge about how this pandemic started. Not many people can say that she could, and she did, but no one listened to her. Instead, the usual liars went to work immediately to discredit her personally. The so-called fact-checking website PolitiFact attacked Dr. Yan's claims as, quote, inaccurate and ridiculous. Now, PolitiFact never explained how they could know that. Did the gender studies majors at PolitiFact have access to superior science? We're thinking they didn't. But they went ahead anyway and accused Dr. Yan of being a, quote, pants-on-fire liar. She should have sued them. That claim was enough for big tech. The media monopolies immediately swooped in to make the whole topic disappear. Facebook censored our interview with Dr. Yan and then deleted it completely. Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, followed suit. Both those companies used PolitiFact's claims to justify their own censorship, and then, of course, CNN swooped in at the end to celebrate the whole thing.
The other day, Carlson interviewed a quote-unquote whistleblower who claimed that she had evidence of a COVID-19 conspiracy in Wuhan, China. But when videos of the interview were shared on social media, Facebook and Instagram intervened by putting a false information label on it.
Catch that? According to CNN, the media monopolies intervened. Right. So this was not a matter of soulless left-wing corporations committing censorship in order to cover for their masters in the Chinese Communist Party. No, not at all. It was instead an intervention. It was done for your good. At the time, of course, there was a political subtext. Donald Trump was the president, and partisans in the media felt they had no choice but to kill this story. If China turned out to be responsible for the COVID-19 pandemic, then Donald Trump would be less responsible for the pandemic, and he might be reelected. So they kept lying for partisan reasons about this virus and the science around it. You saw reporters do the same thing with their coverage of the drug hydroxychloroquine. Once Trump touted hydroxychloroquine, they called it poison, etc. But it's a new day now. Joe Biden's in the White House. They got him elected. So some journalists have decided it is safe and they can now drop the pose. You've seen it over the past several months. A number of prominent liberals have publicly reassessed their views on where this virus came from. Yes, they have admitted, the virus did emerge from a lab in Wuhan. The physical evidence for that is overwhelming. This virus did not evolve in nature. Read the pieces. They're interesting. This virus was instead enhanced during lab experiments, reckless, ghoulish, very dangerous experiments. They were paid for in part by American taxpayers from grants that Tony Fauci himself signed off on. That is all true. They're admitting it now. Even PolitiFact has retracted its claim that Dr. Yan is a pants-on-fire liar. And again, she should sue them. They should be ashamed. Facebook, interestingly, has not reassessed. Apparently, Facebook does far too much business in China to offend the Chinese military. So as of tonight, our interview with Dr. Yan is still missing from Facebook. But Dr. Yan herself is very much still here. She has left her home in China. She cannot return. She cannot speak to her family. She fears arrest were she to go home. She hasn't said move to the United States, a country that she imagined was free. We thought it would be worth talking to her tonight. Dr. Li Mengyan is an independent coronavirus expert, and we're happy to have her. Dr. Yan, thanks so much for coming on. So I have to say, I don't like victory laps in general, but if anyone has been vindicated, if anyone has been proven right, it's you. How do you feel watching the media admit that you're not crazy?
Oh, hi, Tucker. First, thanks for having me again. And also, I want to appreciate your great effort in telling the truth, especially when we have to face so many kind of smearing and attacks from Chinese Communist Party. Thank you. And the thing I feel is now I see more and more people get realized that this virus is not from nature, and it is a result of the lab medicines by gain of function projects. And this project is partly funded by NIH using U.S. taxpayers' money, and the people behind it is the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese Army.
So this was, you know, you came on this show on September 15th. 6 months before that, 7 months before that, Chinese researchers were suggesting the same thing in a paper that we just quoted from at some length. And yet American public health authorities, Francis Collins at NIH, Dr. Tony Fauci, among others, said this is a lie. This is not true. We know for a fact it's not true. Why do you think they said that?
Because this is a big thing China government doesn't want everyone to understand. They want to make it look like from nature, and they recruit their power, their influence in manipulating the misinformation campaign, and they use the even innocent scientists to work with them to spread the nature origin theory, which will mislead people, and the people won't know that it comes from the lab. So they won't notice the motive and also the potential harm behind this pandemic. So that's the reason Chinese Communist Party want to do it, and then they can get enough time to do the things like waste your time and waste your energy, and they can reach their achievement by using this lab-made virus.
Yes, well, they've clearly succeeded in doing that. It's just American researchers, scientists, public health officials are not supposed to lie. They're not supposed to lie, and they did lie. All of them lied. And I should just restate without getting all the science. When you first came on, you explained that, and correct me if I'm wrong, looking at the virus itself, you could tell that this did not emerge from nature, that this was created in a lab.
Yes. I have told that, and I have proved it by presenting the evidence, scientific ones, and also the intelligence evidence in my three published report. And also, what I can further explain to you today is this kind of gain of function modification in this COVID-19 virus is basically not for any good purpose. It's like you want to give a toy gun to your kid as toy, so you will remove the bullet and you will make it safe for a kid. But instead, they make this so-called toy gun with bullet and also even with a sharp knife and a missile on that. Then they give the kid that, see, it's for your toy. So that is means that after this kind of gain of function things, you will see it become very, very dangerous. So no way it is for good purpose. So this is purposely modified and to harm people, to target people.
I'm amazed that you can pull off an analogy like that in a second language. I'm impressed. That sounds exactly right to me. You told the truth about this early. You were attacked for doing that, not just by the Chinese government. Apparently you can't even contact your family back in China, much less go there. But you were attacked in this country by Americans who should know better, who were lying. What has your life been like since you first came on the show?
There are a lot of attacks. And also, I keep working on the things, keep providing evidence, and many of evidence are verified gradually by independent source. And I'm happy to see more and more people realize this is a lab-made virus, come from Chinese Communist Party. That is a good thing. And also, what I want to say is, now we really need to call for all the society, the scientific society, medical society, and also government people to realize this is very dangerous virus now, and this is a lab-made thing since the things already proved, and then you will realize that there are more things, more secret hidden in the virus, although you may not see the clear outcome immediately, but this is purposely modified to target human. So we should give more pressure to Chinese Communist Party to ask them tell what they have done to manipulate this virus, and also we need to work together to study those random and also intentionally results come out from the virus, which gave the harm things to human. We need to solve these things together. We should not stay in the lies again.
Amen. This could be more dangerous than we realize. I think it's a scary point, but a good one. You should get the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And in a fair, honest country, you would. Dr. Li Mengyan, I appreciate your coming on tonight. Thank you. I know our viewers do also.
Thank you, Tucker.
There's beginning to be mounting evidence that many employers are beginning to require their employees to take the vaccine. We don't believe that it's a real vaccine. But Robert Barnes, recently interviewed by Owen Schroyer, points out the liabilities for employers that are trying to force their employees to take the vaccine as a condition of their employment. And I think it's going to cause a lot of problems and liabilities to those employers. Here we go with Robert Barnes.
Every employer out there should not be mandating this. That's all the risk is on them. They're taking on risk of ADA lawsuits, risk of violating informed consent and invasion of privacy lawsuits, risk of wrongful termination, violation of public policy lawsuits, and significantly, huge tail liability if anybody suffers any adverse consequence from this vaccine. And remember, a lot of times the adverse consequences from it don't appear until years later. That's the nature of this. So if you're an employer, you're crazy to mandate a vaccine as a condition of employment. So that's where and I think that's the first step. Is once informed employees and employers are informed, I think a lot of employers will step back and not force this. Now, if they do, then you get to the second stage of potential litigation. And at this point, they are not immune by mandating vaccines. Many states have passed laws prohibiting employers or anybody from requiring vaccines as a condition of access to employment, condition of access to travel, condition of access to entertainment, condition of access to education. So now the states that are trying to compel it, trying to require it, that's going to be a major constitutional battle to come.
Here's the story. Robert Barnes joins us. Oregon, California, New York are having a soft implementation of mandatory vaccines. Like, oh, we won't go door to door and force you to take a needle, but if you want to go to work, if you want to go to church, if you want to get on the subway, if you want to go to dinner, if you want to go to the grocery store, so just all your essential activities, you're going to need a vaccine for that. But, oh, they're not mandatory, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're witnessing is a range of both employers and educational institutions are trying to impose a mandate on it. And so Robert Kennedy's group, Children's Health Defense, started drafting some objections and legal claims and examples of what letters might look like. And I did the same thing. So I drafted a letter that reflects what an employee could object to, and it's not legal advice or anything like that. It's basically just here's what the objections that could be made that other employees have been making and that I believe is the legally correct objection to be made, because the nature of this COVID-19 vaccine at this point is still an emergency use authorization vaccine. It is not a regular FDA clinical trial approved vaccine. Consequently, under federal law, that cannot be mandated, period. The precondition of it even being distributed and being authorized is that it not be mandated without informed consent. It's part one of the objection. Two is that it really violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, because the Americans with Disabilities Act makes clear that you cannot do certain medical examinations except when business necessity compels it. You cannot compel people to provide medical information aside from when there's some public business necessity. And in this context, that has not yet been met. And so they don't have clear and convincing evidence that being vaccinated is critical and essential to reducing a substantial risk to others of transmitting COVID-19 in such a way that it can cause severe bodily harm without the COVID vaccine. And so and in almost every instance, one can make reasonable accommodations to limit whatever that risk they believe is. But right now there's inadequate data and evidence either that the vaccine is safe and effective in the sense that it has not yet met FDA clinical trial test standards. We have reasons to be skeptical and suspect of the vaccine because the makers of it and the distributors of it are completely immune from liability in case they've done something wrong or have a bad product. We have other reasons to be suspect of it because the media and YouTube and social media are basically we're censoring and suppressing any information.
Let me just interject one point, too. The companies that are making this vaccine, manufacturing it, have paid out the record highest payouts for health fraud violations.
Yeah, I mean, no question. I mean, you have There are every reason to distrust it. If we're going to trust a vaccine, first, at least it should meet FDA clinical trial testing. This one's now nowhere close to it. That's years away. But it should not be an emergency use authorized vaccine that could ever be mandated against us. And that goes to not only does federal law prohibit that under the Americans with Disabilities Act and under the emergency use authorization provisions of the very act that authorized the FDA in the first place, but it violates international law that has become part of American law because it was created and instigated and pushed on the rest of the world by the United States, which is the Nuremberg Code of 1947. And the federal courts have recognized that the Nuremberg Code of 1947 is enforceable in the United States courts. In fact, this last time this happened was Romney and the Bush administration tried to force experimental vaccines on people going to Iraq in 2002 and 2003, and the United States Federal District Court said, no, you can't do that. You have to have informed consent if it's any kind of experimental vaccine, because this goes back to the Nuremberg Code that said no more medical experimentation, treating human beings as guinea pigs without their informed consent. And that's why I believe that these various mandates do not conform to the Nuremberg Code, do not conform to federal law. Employers and universities are violating the provisions protecting against discrimination against people based on perceived medical treatment. And that's what the draft letter reflects. And people can, there's no copyright being asserted, so people can cut and paste from it however they want. It's, again, it's not legal advice. Whatever you want to do with it, you're free to do with it. But no copyright claim. Do with it as you wish. But there is ways to push back and resist, and the goal is to create something that's easy for people to use to do just that.
We're back here on the Alex Jones Show, broadcasting live at freeworldnews.tv. Bob Barnes is with us, and we're discussing how in California, Oregon, New York, and other places soon, I'm sure, are saying you have to be vaccinated to go back to work or go to church, but we're not forcing you to do it. Just anywhere you go to leave your house, you have to have it, but we're not forcing you. And so, Bob, you have just put up a letter there that's free to use, not legal advice, but just ways people can stand up for their rights and know the law when it comes to these forced vaccines. But let's talk about potential litigation here. I mean, there's so many ways that this can go, and there's going to be real world, like, peer-to-peer interactions that are going to become really awkward, I think, from this, but we'll get to that later. What happens when they really start rolling this out? What happens when employers force their employees to take this vaccine illegally? What happens then? What happens when the litigation starts flying?
Well, I think that's where the first step is. If somebody's out there and their college, their school, their state, their county, their employer is saying they have to take the vaccine and are demanding the disclosure of whether they've taken it, I think the first step is sending back a letter like this, because that will put them on notice and see how they respond. A lot of employers don't know that the emergency use authorization law does not authorize them to mandate a vaccine. Most employers do not know that the Nuremberg Code is invoked because this is an experimental vaccine. Most employers do not know that the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits them from asking questions about people's medical information unless there's business necessity for it. Basically, the legal standard for and under the ADA for when, like, some people are getting confused because they think HIPAA applies. HIPAA applies to what an employer can do with your medical information, not how it gathers it. What it's the ADA that led the Americans with Disabilities Act that precludes your employer from going out and asking questions about your medical information. And unfortunately, there's a lot of bad lawyers out there, or lawyers that are politically motivated, telling people that, oh, there's no problem with this, when clearly there's a problem with this. Even the CDC and OSHA and the EEOC, when they issued various guidances, they've said to be careful in this space. But employers are a lot of lawyers, because they love the vaccine, because they're, you know, Bill Gates fan club types, Trump hater types, forced vaccine fans, just like the crowd that supported eugenics in the 20s and 30s, a lot of lawyers and doctors in that space. are misstating the law. And so the first step for people is to get educated on the law. The second step is to push back by just asking letter, putting in information like this in a letter to your employer, to anyone else. You don't have to hire a lawyer for it. You can just say, hey, this is my understanding, and make sure the employer, probably this will be the first time they've heard of this. The other big thing is employers don't realize, not only could they be sued under various tort theories and invasions of privacy under state law, but on top of this, even the CDC has come out and said, by the way, employers, if you mandate the vaccine and there's and the person, your employee, suffers any injury from it, you are liable. So unlike the drug companies who are off the hook because of special immunity, employers are not off the hook if they require people to take the vaccine and they suffer any medical injury. They could be on the hook for life. They could be on the hook for wrongful death claims. They could be on the hook for lifetime injury claims. So the almost no employer realizes this.
No, this is actually so key. And this is the official statement from the government and OSHA and everything. And to draw back on that, it's kind of like the same dynamic of if somebody went to get a vaccine and the people distributing the vaccine were going to be held liable for any damages, then maybe they won't distribute it. But you don't have that same dynamic here. What you have is the employer now kind of a reroute, though. This will be another way to crush small businesses. Small businesses won't be able to handle this litigation. They won't be able to handle these lawsuits, whereas big businesses maybe can or will somehow be grandfathered into some exemption clause. So there's like another slash waiting to happen when this goes down.
Well, that's why every employer out there should not be mandating this. All the risk is on them. They're taking on risk of ADA lawsuits, risk of violating informed consent and invasion of privacy lawsuits, risk of wrongful termination and violation of public policy lawsuits, and significantly huge tail liability if anybody suffers any adverse consequence from this vaccine. And remember, a lot of times the adverse consequences from it don't appear until years later. That's the nature of this. So if you're an employer, you're crazy to mandate a vaccine as a condition of employment. So that's where I think that's the first step is that once informed employees and employers are informed, I think a lot of employers will step back and not force this. Now, if they do, then you get to the second stage of potential litigation. And at this point, they are not immune by mandating vaccines. Many states have passed laws prohibiting employers or anybody from requiring vaccines as a condition of access to employment, condition of access to travel, condition of access to entertainment, condition of access to education. So now the states that are trying to compel it, trying to require it, they have major. That's going to be a major constitutional battle to come. So while the Supreme Court has approved mandatory vaccines on condition of a fine. In one case in 1905, the Jacobson decision, and a later children's school vaccine case, they've always allowed exemptions to be present for religion and other reasons. And they've also always required a strict evidentiary standard. It has to be clear and convincing evidence that the vaccine is safe and effective and that it prevents a substantial risk of severe health injury to others. It can't just be to protect the person. It has to be that this vaccine reduces transmission at such a rate that it is going to be a substantial benefit at reducing severe bodily harm. And they don't have clear and convincing evidence of that. So that's where that litigation is going to go. That's where we're going to contest it, try to reestablish the Nuremberg principles in the context of states or federal governments mandating this, because then that's a constitutional question. Right now, it's a question under the ADA, a question under the Emergency Use Authorization Act, a question under invasion of privacy laws, a question under the Nuremberg Code. If a governmental actor requires it, the Nuremberg Code comes back into play, but also the Constitution of the United States. And I believe we can show there is not clear and convincing evidence that a vaccine provides a substantial reduction in the risk of severe bodily injury simply by reducing the risk of transmission. Because let's just look at it. Aside from the big questions about whether the vaccine is safe and effective, given it's still in the emergency experimental stage, given that the very nature of this vaccine is experimental and it's mRNA technology for many of the vaccines, given the controversy surrounding this vaccine in terms of coronavirus vaccines having no history of success, there's all of those problems. But to the just question of transmission, the probability, the only thing the COVID vaccine does that simply isolation won't do if you get it, is to deal with people that are asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic. So you're talking about a tiny, tiny group of people. The risk of that group of people transmitting the virus is even more tiny. The risk that that group transmits it and causes severe bodily injury is even more tiny. And in fact, some early studies have shown, at least in the context of children, that the risk from the vaccine is greater than the risk from COVID.
So you've got to listen to Robert Barnes. He has some important things to say. And here we go. Just going to make some commentary here on different aspects of what's going on throughout the world. We've got this ceasefire in the Middle East between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The Palestinians supposedly fired 4,000 rockets indiscriminately into Israel, and there were some deaths on the Israeli side, but they're well prepared with a defense system. So they have shelters and everything else, warning systems and so forth. So they did minimize. Thank goodness there is a ceasefire. Of course, Israel came in there and toppled some buildings. There was a building that AP and Al Jazeera were in. There's controversy over, you know, what happened on that. And it remains to be seen how much, if this ceasefire will hold. And we hope that it will hold. And, of course, there's an ongoing, controversy about the virus. We have that on an ongoing basis and so forth. And it's being debated now about whether or not that the vaccine is truly a vaccine. There's evidence now that it's actually a gene therapy type of mechanism, and this can be very dangerous. We've also had the Nord Stream 2 that was recently, there were sanctions on some of the officials that headed that, and those were taken down by Biden just recently, and so he dropped those. There were different leaders, German leaders, that were heading this up, and one of them was a former chancellor. And his name was Gerhard Schroeder, and he's not even mentioned. He was not only involved, he's involved as the chairman of this company, this building back, but he was involved with the Russians and with their energy company also. So when we're talking about the Germans, and their involvement with the Russians, we've got to be careful. Also, Matthias Warnick, who was he was mentioned that dropped some sanctions against him as one of the officers of his company building that. And Matthias Warnick, Warnick is his name of Deutsch. He's the chief executive officer of the Nord Stream AG, a company for construction and operation of the Nord Stream submarine gas pipeline from Russia to Germany. Okay, his career started at the Stasi, the secret police of Communist East Germany. And allegedly he worked with a KGB officer at that time, that was Vladimir Putin. The two men collaborated on recruiting West German citizens. So in other words, this thing is a who's who of the spy wax museum. And then Gerhard Schroeder, who was a former chancellor of Germany, is involved with Russian energy companies and also involved with the building of this. So why did Biden then drop sanctions on this? The reason why that he dropped sanctions is that the total and these people are, but I mentioned Gerhard Schroeder and Warnick, are tied back to the Rothschild interest and to different banking interests also. But the overall long-term plan is to transform the world into a world communist state. And so that's why they're in bed with the Russians at times, and they're, you know, benefiting each other, because the Russians can help spread communism worldwide that way. But also right now, they're in bed with all these corporations that have made big, big contributions in this country to Tides Foundation and Tides Center. Tides Foundation and Tides Center redistributes to all of these different radical leftist groups that are trying to transform America into a communist state. Now, why they got together and got rid of Trump was Trump was not for world communism, much less communism in this country. And that's why General Flynn stood up with him, and they got rid of him early on with some false type of accusations and so forth. They kicked him out as security, national security director for Trump, because he knew what this was all about, and he was adamantly against many of these things that they were about, you know. So what they're doing now is they're trying to institute some kind of white, anti-white. There's this Lori Lightfoot up in Chicago, mayor of Chicago, is saying, I'm not going to give interviews to any white reporters and so forth. Well, how racist is that? That's very racist. But also there's a report that Tucker just broadcast recently about Washington State school districts and their staff being indoctrinated with all this communist stuff. And so here we go with that short report now.
The state of Washington just made anti-white training mandatory for all staff in all public schools. Jason Rantz has been following the story. He's a radio show host out in Seattle. He joins us tonight. Hey, Jason. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Mandatory, huh?
Yeah, it's mandatory. And just to go over some of the training, only white people can be racist. Slavery was never actually abolished. Low-income white people actually are benefiting from their white privilege. Now, that's just from Highline Public Schools. This is a district a little bit south of Seattle. Now, according to the law, all of these schools actually have to start teaching the so-called anti-racist equity training, which is actually in favor of racism and does not lead to equitable outcomes, quite the opposite. But there are a lot of school districts all across the state that are already doing this. And this is one district, for example, that's been doing this for years. They've got a race symposium, which is where that video came from. So one teacher who was pretty upset about the documents that were put in front of this teacher and some of the videos and the training actually leaked a lot of this to me. And I just pulled some of the cuts, including race as a social construct created to advance white supremacy, and that if you get defensive when you're called a racist, well, of course, that's also white supremacy culture in action. They're being told that
may I interrupt you right there? Wait, I mean, I don't think any of us want to live in a country where people are racially self-conscious, where you think about your race all the time. That you don't want to live in that place. It's Rwanda. It's bad. Has it occurred to any of these geniuses that they are going to make your average white person racially self-aware, some of them really radical, in a bad way, if they keep up with this crap, if they keep attacking people on the basis of qualities that those people can't control? Like, they're creating radicalism. Do they know that?
I don't think they realize that they're doing that, because they're talking to a very specific group of people that they're trying to become subservient to an ideological cause. And they think they're justified in the shaming, the race-based shaming that they're doing to these people and eventually doing to these kids. That's really what this is about. They're not really focused on the adults. They're not talking to the adults. They're talking to the kids. This training right now is going to be to the staff members. But the end goal is to propagandize, indoctrinate children. That's the end goal. And when you get all of our nation's kids believing this garbage, this trash, this toxic thinking, well, then when they're in charge, it doesn't matter that older folks who are dying out actually hold that position. That's how they think. They're trying to create a revolution, one critical race theory training session at a time. It really is nefarious in its intent. And I don't think they realize or really care about the danger that it's creating in this environment. And thankfully, there are teachers who are leaking a lot of this stuff out, who are complaining, and who aren't going to put this in front of kids. But it's the parents that really need to step up and protect them from this.
Yeah, stop being passive. Put down the bomb.
Yeah.
Do something about this. This will wreck the country. For real. This is really scary. I appreciate your reporting on it. Jason Rantz, thank you.
Thanks, Tucker.
Next is a definition from Prager University of a very, very good definition of critical race theory. And this really puts it out there, and it really simplifies it, but it also clears up exactly what it's all about. It's not about civil rights whatsoever. It's against that. It's really creating division in this country. So listen very carefully. Here we go with this good definition.
Have you heard about critical race theory? I'm guessing you probably have. It has already insinuated itself into many institutions and is making rapid progress into others. If it takes hold, it will completely change the very nature of America and the way you live. Critical race theory holds that the most important thing about you is your race. The color of your skin, that's who you are. Not your behavior, not your values, not your environment. Your race. In critical race theory, if you are a member of a minoritized racial group, their term, not mine, you are a victim of a system that is rigged against you, a system that doesn't want you to succeed. On the other hand, if your race is privileged, you're an exploiter, whether you intend to be or not. Critical race theory begins from the assumption that racism occurs in all interactions. To see how this works, consider this thought experiment. Imagine you own a shop and two customers enter at the same time, one white and one black. Who do you help first? If you help the black person first, critical race theory would say you did so because you don't trust black people to be left alone in your store. That's racist. If you help the white person first instead, critical race theory would say you did so because you think blacks are second-class citizens. That's racist too. That's critical race theory. It can find racism in anything, even if it has to read your mind to do it. Critical race theory is a uniquely American invention. Brewed up at Harvard Law School in the 70s, now part of the academic and media mainstream, it is also uniquely un-American because it rejects the core tenets of the American, classically liberal Judeo-Christian value system. It turns the bedrock American idea upside down. Here it is in the words of Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanchik, two leading proponents. Critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, Enlightenment rationalism, and the neutral principles of constitutional law. It does this because critical race theory proponents assume racism is present everywhere and always, and they look for it critically until they find it. And they always find it. It has to be there because that's how the imperial European powers and then America set things up. Here, as in all dangerous academic theories, there is a kernel of truth. Human beings were not preoccupied with race until the 16th century, when Europeans began to explore and then colonize other parts of the world. Drawing distinctions between the races reached its peak in the 19th century with the widespread use of slave labor in North and South America. No one denies this. But since then, the Western world, and most especially America, has spent a lot of time, money, and blood breaking free of its racist past. It's been a rocky road for sure, but great progress has been made. Critical race theory says all this progress is a mirage. Racism never died, never even faded a little bit. It just hid itself better. Critical race theory, therefore, is not a continuation of the civil rights movement. It is, in fact, a repudiation of it. To critical race theorists, Martin Luther King was both wrong and naive. White Americans can never judge blacks by the content of their character. They can only judge them, always unfavorably, consciously or unconsciously, by the color of their skin. Ironically, not since the Aryan obsession in Germany in the 1930s and 1940s, or South African apartheid in the second half of the 20th century, has the social movement been so obsessed with race. Critical race theory is then, in a very real sense, a counter-American revolution. But that's a positive, not a negative to those who subscribe to the theory. The American experiment was given a 400-year tryout, and it doesn't work. So let's scrap it. That's what they believe. Is that what you believe? I'm going to guess that most of you don't. So how do we stop critical race theory before it infects the brains of too many decent Americans, especially young people, and turns us into something we have never been and shouldn't ever want to be? The answer is simple. Refuse to accept it. Don't be intimidated by the heads I win, tails you lose logic of this self-destructive, America-hating, anti-reality idea. Don't be bullied into thinking that you're racist when you know you're not, or that you're a victim when you know you're not. Defend yourself while you still can. I'm James Lindsay, founder of New Discourses for Prager University.
We're going to finish this last few minutes with Victor David Hansen on Western Civilization. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Good night.
I'd like to speak just for, if it's possible, for 10 or 15 minutes on the West, Western Civilization, and then the crisis, why there's a crisis, and then what happened, and if there's any hope. But I'll just preface it. I was talking to a friend at Hillsdale once, not once, just in September, and he says, you know, I can't watch the NBA anymore. And I said, well, I haven't watched an NFL game. That's an escape. I don't want to be lectured when I turn on TV. And he said, Major League Baseball's gone. So we were, and then he said, have you been to a movie lately? I said, why would I want to watch a poor remake of a Hollywood? There's not an idea in that whole city. So then he said, do you care whether there's a firewall for the New York Times? I said, I haven't read it in 5 years. He said, I haven't read the Washington Post. He said, have you watched network news? I said, I don't even know what it is anymore. And he said, when people come to Hillsdale, does it make much difference if they have a PhD from Stanford or Harvard? I said, nope. I'd rather talk to somebody in Fresno. So what he was saying is that we all are having a monastery of the mind. We've withdrawn from all of these wonderful institutions, and we've said to ourselves, I can't take part of it. These were created by great people who are dead, but they've been corrupted, all of them. And it's very difficult now, because I always say to my wife, we get up one morning and we see this chaos on the screen, on the internet, outside our front door. And I say, we're Augustine and we're living in Carthage about 440 AD, and the Vandals are outside the walls, metaphorically. And it's a very difficult time to be alive. I have a lot of empathy for people who get up every morning and they go out there and they're undaunted. But what is most upsetting is this civilization that gives us such freedom, such material bounty, security, luxury, and then it creates such disdain for it. It was almost as if, well, we want all of the bounties of this civilization. We want all of these golden eggs, and we want to strangle this goose. And I'd like to suggest to you in the next 10 minutes, that's the only reassuring thing that's not new. And it's caught up in the contradictions of our very civilization. So what we call the West is just, why wasn't the East? Because the Greeks had no problem about being ethnocentric. 7th and 8th century B.C., they got up in the morning and they said everything they noticed that seems to set where the sun was, everything over there was like them, and everything where the sun rises, the Oriens or the Orient, was different. They decided the world was them versus Persia. And the Occidens were the Occidentals, where the sun set in the west, was a different culture. They were pretty prescient. And so out of nowhere, about 800 B.C., we had these 1,500 city-states, only about 1.5 million people in 50,000 square miles, very small place. They were tried to be strangled by the Persians that had a kingdom of 30 million people and could not. And these 1,500 city-states started to reject all of the contemporary premises, the dynastic civilizations in Egypt, the birth of civilization in the Near East, the tribal cultures of Europe. Nothing to do with race. My ancestors in Sweden were killing each other and doing all sorts of things the Greeks would have thought barbaric. And out of this culture, they started to have a system of law, inheritance. I think you could say that constitutional government was birthed in Greece around 750, not for equality, not for freedom, but for the protection of property and to be able to hand it down without government interference to your family, something we take for granted. But that was the spark that made people create these constitutional governments. And then the rest followed over the next 150 years. Consensual government, rule of law rather than people. Free market economies, very primitive, but still free market and private property. Rationalism, the ability to explain natural phenomenon without resort to superstition or religion. Didn't mean they weren't religious. They just said there's an element that we can't explain scientifically. That's mystery. It's a good Greek word. But the rest of the world, why the sun comes up in a certain way and sets in a certain way the stars, why, what's water and earth, and all of that can be explained without superstition. And for a country that was very close to starvation, it was always one harvest away from annihilation, they were very enlightened. We say, well, we're a sexist civilization. Compared to what? Compared to Egypt? Compared to the Goths? I mean, if you look at the titles of plays in Greece, the Antigone, the Helen, the Andromache, the Trojan women, they're heroes. Lysistrata. So they were already talking about the equality of the sexes. You say, well, they had slavery. Every society in the world had slavery. Nobody at this time had anybody like Alcidamas who said, no man is born a slave. And that was a topic of intense debate. And then there was this idea of self-criticism. We'll get back to that later. But you had the right to critique the very system you created without fear of retribution. Now, this was not set in stone. There were revolutions. There were people who tried to destroy it. But that was the contribution to the West from Greece. When Rome took over, because they had no word in their vocabulary, natio, equivalent in Greek, there was no nationhood. How can you preserve a civilization when there's 1,500 city-states? You can do it if you're Alexander the Great, but you have to destroy freedom in the process. He didn't destroy all of West, but Rome took over the Mediterranean, and they added to this menu, this formula. And one of the things they did was create a tripart system of government. This is very important because our founders did not want an Athenian-style democracy where on any given day the assembly could do whatever they wanted when 51% of the people said, let's kill all the Mytileneans today. They've been bad. And then they said, yeah, it's a good idea. They get up the next morning and said, that was kind of extreme. I'm quoting basically Thucydides. So the next morning they got up and said, let's not kill them. They said, well, we already sent the ship out. So I said, well, we'll give volunteers and give them free food and a bonus. Maybe. And we have this great scene in the history where they're all got their necks ready to be cut and somebody comes in and says, stop, just cut 1,500 necks, not everybody. And so that's what scared the Romans. So they had a tripart system, two consuls and executive. And then they had tribal assemblies, a lower house, and the Senate, same as ours, Senate. And then they had tribunals that were a judiciary, very influential on Montesquieu and the French Enlightenment. And they codified law, and they had basic, in other words, they took the spirit of the Greeks, and they said it doesn't work, it doesn't apply to every day. What happens if you're arrested? You have to have habeas corpus. And most of our law today is Latinate, not Greek, because the Romans were wonderful codifiers. And most important, they were wonderful assimilators. This was the only civilization the world said that you do not have to be Italian to be Roman by the first century B.C. and first century A.D. And by 80 A.D., there was not going to be any more Italian emperors. In other words, Rome became not what Joe Biden said. What Joe Biden said the other night, America was an idea. No, it is a reality. It's not was an idea. There wouldn't be a Europe today if it was an idea. Somebody had to reify that idea and go over in World War I, World War II, and the Cold War, etc. But Rome was a concept that you could be Roman and not have to look Italian. Very radical idea. That if you accepted Romanness, so if you were a Gaul and you were conquered by the Romans, they didn't just say, we're going to take over and destroy you. He said, we will allow your children to wear togas and they can speak Latin and they can become Roman. That's a pretty radical idea at the time. And there was a final component in this menu, and of course that was Jerusalem. And that was the idea that by the first century AD, there was a new element that challenged classical morality. Classical morality was you be no better friend, there's no better friend and no worse enemy. There's no such thing as turn the other cheek. There's no such thing as Sermon on the Mount. If you're a good Greek or a good Roman, you punish your enemies and help your friend. And that's the definition of your morality. And this new idea comes in very revolutionary because it transcended class and hierarchy and status and said, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. And if you're the historian like Gibbon, you say, well, this caused the fall of Rome because how can you run a country on land? Or if you're Gibbon in your writing about the fall of Constantinople, and he says, you know, the people on the walls are getting penance to ask forgiveness to kill Muslims, and the Muslims below are being challenged, being promised 72 virgins in heaven for every Christian they kill, and that's a very asymmetrical incentive. So how can you defeat people like that? So there was a problem already in classical. I'm getting, just telling you about the formation, because some of these contradictions are coming to the fore.
Thank each and every one of you for listening tonight, and God bless each and every one of you. So good night.